Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show here. We once again renewed our irreverence on the Global Bureau of Irreverence's annual rankings. We are out irreverenting everyone, and we are so irreverent, we're doing a rare Friday show. We're going to kick back and let loose from the exhibition hall at the Canada Strong and Free Network's annual conference in Ottawa. Now, as you saw from the arm that protruded in front of my shot there, we have a special guest with us, none other than Franco Terrazzoni. Couldn't have just waited for the intro, but we loved having Franco on the show as our regular tax fighter from time to time. He works with our good friend Chris Sims at the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. And the one thing that we all know about the conservative movement, you know, red Tories, blue Tories, social conservatives, libertarians, all tend to converge on this idea that government should not spend so much. So with this government, you have probably had a fair bit of work in the last few years, have you not, sir?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, business is booming in a bad way for taxpayers. I mean, the government is spending like crazy. We have a budget that's going to be announced on Tuesday. And so far, this government's approach to budgeting has been spend more on everything forever. You know, that's not a good way to manage your household finances. It's not a good way to manage a business. And it's definitely not a good way to manage the finances of a country.
This upcoming budget's a bit interesting because normally a budget is this closely held state secret where the government waits until markets close to come out and release it because it is market moving information. In this one, we've had the government doing this like campaign style rollout, making budget announcement after budget announcement. And so far, all I've heard in this has been more spending. And I don't know if you've been keeping a tally on it, but what do we know about the budget so far from what has been announced?
Well, okay, so we know that the government is just going to keep diving into debt, right? Spend, billions of dollars likely in additional spending. And what's so worrisome about that is that even before all these spending announcements, the parliamentary budget officer says you're looking at a deficit of around $40 billion. Okay, we're in, what, 2024, right? We're not in these pandemic years, and the government is still running these massive deficits that were, like, unthinkable only a couple years ago, right? And one of the big problems with these massive deficits is the massive amount of money that's being wasted on interest charges, okay? So, like, this year, federal interest charges are probably going to cost more than what the federal government sends to the provinces in health transfers.
Wow.
Like, how ridiculous is that, right? And in a couple years' time, let's look at 2028, debt interest charges will probably cost more than the amount of money the federal government brings in its GST. Okay, so let's put that into perspective. Every time you go to the store and you pay the federal sales tax, in a couple years' time, every penny collected through that sales tax will go to paying interest on the federal credit card.
That's so crucial, and it's something that I can't stress enough whenever I talk about this with people, is that it's not just about spending outside your means. It's that it limits your buying power as a government, which is, you know, taxpayer money, obviously, forever. I mean, when you talk about that health transfer, anyone who's ever had a health care issue in any province in Canada, just think of what government could spend the money that went on debt service on hospital bed, on an MRI machine, on any of these things. And that's such a point that seems to be completely absent from the discussion from government, certainly this government.
Well, you know what's always in the conversation, unfortunately, with this federal government? Taxes.
Yeah.
Right? We already know that taxes are making life more expensive. We just saw the carbon tax increase. That really impacts all of the necessities of life. It makes it more expensive for you to fuel up your car. It makes it more expensive for you to stay warm during the winter months. And it makes it more expensive for you to buy groceries.
Yep.
And on that, we've seen not just the NDP in Sing, but also some Liberal MPs musing about a grocery tax. Now, hello, a new tax on groceries is not going to bring down the price of food.
Yeah.
It's going to make your life more expensive. And, you know, only a couple years ago, Trudeau was asked about the possibility of a grocery tax, and he said that they don't want to bring a tax in that will be passed on to the consumer. And that's exactly what these types of so-called excess profit taxes, especially on the grocery sector, would do. It would just make life more expensive. And, Andrew, you know, if the federal government really wanted to bring down food prices, scrap the carbon tax.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you can look at all of these different levers that government has available to it. And some parts of inflation are global in nature. They aren't things that government can necessarily take responsibility for. Other things governments can. And you know, when you're talking about families that are struggling to make ends meet, and every now and then we see consumer spending surveys that show, I forget the exact number I saw in the recent one, but a large volume of Canadians are within $200 of not being able to meet their monthly expenses. So for people in that, a 10%, 12% increase on something is quite significant.
Yeah, and let's bring this back to the budget and the deficit, right? Because you're so right to point out that inflation comes from many factors. Mm-hmm. But you know what the government can control? How much it taxes, how much it spends, and how much it prints money. Now, what happened during the COVID years? Well, there was something that was different than in normal times. Well, many things, but one of them is that the central bank, the Bank of Canada, had the money printer on overdrive. Okay, so during the pandemic years, the Bank of Canada printed more than $300 billion. Yeah. New dollars, right out of thin air, dropped into an economy that had revolving lockdowns, right? So it created too many dollars chasing too few goods. That's one of the reasons that you saw prices across the board skyrocket. Now, going back to the taxes, you know, we could see like a different excess profits tax go in, and we already know that the economy is struggling, and this would chase away investment, this would hurt Canadian businesses, and would cause a whole lot of economic damage.
Now, you used a line there that we've heard Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre use as well, about chasing few goods. And I was wondering if you could explain, is he using your language or are you using his, or is it a bit of both? Because I'm curious if you're actually finding that you've been leading the Conservative movement in some ways on this.
Well, you know, I think the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, we've been really pushing the needle. We've been banging the drum against the crazy overspending and how that drives up inflation. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the carbon tax for so many years. We've been talking about the fact that the government raises its alcohol tax. I know this conversation could probably drive you to drink, but sorry, folks, they're taking more money out of your pocket when you go buy a bottle of beer as well. So we've been banging the drum on this forever. So it's good to see at least one party, some other MPs, maybe some independent MPs, really get on the bandwagon here and just understand that the federal government's overtaxing, overspending, and that money printing is really making life harder for Canadians.
We have heard the federal government say that there's not going to be a tax on the middle class, an increase in a tax on the middle class. Now, the definition of the middle class is one that the government has infamously not provided, even when it had a minister for the middle class. But they aren't ruling out tax increases in general. And I would say if people jump up and down and say, well, yeah, I'm middle class, so I'm not too worried about it. Why should that be a cautious or concerning position?
Well, first of all, hey, you guys hear about that story? Just last year, Trudeau took a 6-day trip to the Indo-Pacific region, spent, what, $2 million on a 6-day trip, including $200,000 on airplane food? Mm-hmm. Ask yourself this. Why do you want to give the government any more money? From any Canadian, right? They're just going to waste it on themselves. But the second thing is like, look, you bring in business taxes, you bring in wealth taxes, you bring in excess profit taxes or a grocery tax, two things happen. Number one, like a grocery tax, that just flows through to the consumer, right? So there's higher prices at the store every time you go do your grocery haul. But number two, taxes on like business or a wealth tax, that drives away investment. That hurts the Canadian economy. And right now, we all know that the economy is already struggling. Canadians are already struggling. So this is probably the worst possible time to bring in these very damaging taxes. Like I said, create a lot of economic damage.
Yeah, no, they do. And it was ironic because you go back 2 years and there was the Freedom Convoy protest. And the government, when it was defending that, said that economic harm was a national emergency, which means we need like the Emergencies Act on the federal budget with how things are going. Like, how bad are you expecting it to be? Because on one hand, it's a government that wants to win re-election next year. So you'd think they'd have to put forward some vision that will be palatable to Canadians. But what are you anticipating?
I'm anticipating massive deficits. But look, pretty much all of these budgets have been pretty bad, right?
Yeah.
I feel like Mr. Trudeau has not met a budget target that he could just blow by, right? Remember when he was first running to be prime minister in 2015? He said they'd run, you know, these tiny little deficits of about $10 billion
a
year.
Yeah, just small little ones.
Hey, don't worry, folks. We'll balance the budget in 2019. Well, what happened?
Yeah.
They missed that target by about $20 billion even before the pandemic. And look, like the parliamentary budget officer shows that the next time under the current trajectory that we would see a balanced budget from Ottawa is like 2035. But that doesn't even consider any additional spending. And so when we see them announce spending, borrowing, I honestly think it's going to be bad news for Canadians. And, you know, let's not forget that if this government doesn't find the spine to actually save money, actually cut spending, they're going to clobber taxpayers.
I have a feeling that when we see, you know, this, it's going to get a lot worse. And the challenge will be for a conservative government that comes in, or theoretically a government that is going to be different from this one, that they're going to say, listen, our hands are tied. We can't do anything here. It's just so bad. And I know you've always been, as an organization, very good at not letting conservative parties off the hook either. And I wanted to ask what your realistic expectation would be of a conservative government on balance the budget. How long would you give them before you start start to say, hey, listen, guys, you're part of the problem now?
Well, we need a complete detailed plan to balance the budget immediately. And why I say right away is because, well, if you give them a couple years, they're going to drag their feet. Yep, they're going to keep pushing the goalposts further and further. It's like, hey, Andrew, I'm going to go on a diet next week.
Yeah.
What happens?
I know I've been saying that for the last 10 years.
So like, so here's the thing, right? This is why it's so important to actually balance the budget immediately, stop this deep dive into debt. And here's how they should do it. Number one, stop the wasteful spending, right? The Fed spent $8 million building a barn at Rideau Hall. Now, I don't know the first thing about farming, but I'm pretty sure my buddies in Brooks know how to build a barn for less than $8 million.
Yeah.
Okay, then you got to go after the big things. Stop the corporate welfare. This government is seemingly giving billions of dollars to everybody and their dog who wants to build some batteries. Number three, you got to cut down the bureaucracy, okay? The Trudeau government has added 100,000 new bureaucrats since taking office. They've handed out $1 billion in bonuses despite federal departments not even being able to meet half of their own performance targets. So you got the little things you got to do, and you got to do the big things right as well.
Yeah, and I mean, and defunding CBC, that's become like a chant line.
Defund the CBC.
Liam, throw me one of those baseball caps there. This is a new one that I haven't seen. So there's defund the CBC, and you guys also have this one booth here.
So it says defund the CRA.
Yeah, exactly. I
wish I could take credit for it, but this is actually not a CTF hat.
Oh.
But let me tell you, folks, people are getting even more frustrated with the CRA, right? You got a problem. Good luck trying to get them on the phone. You know, we do hear more rumblings about this automatic tax filing, and my first thing is like, these guys can't even do the basics things right. Like, why do you want to give the CRA more power over your lives?
Yeah, no, fair enough. All right, I thought it was yours. It was on your booth, but I guess it was like a generous contribution. Yeah, get rid of that thing. All right, well, Franco D'Arizzano, good to see you in person, sir, and thanks so much for coming on. I look forward to probably having you on around the budget time as well.
Oh, that'd be great, man. Thank you so much.
All right, that was Franco D'Arizzano, Federal Director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. And like I have said time and time again, man does not live on tax policy alone. You can't just win an election by trying to be a fiscal conservative. I think we've seen in the past when conservatives narrow the debate a little bit too much. So I wanted to look outside of Canada for this next segment. Earlier today, I caught up with the former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. Well, the Canada Strong and Free Networks annual conference isn't just an assembly of conservatives from across the country, but also from around the world. One of the fantastic speakers this year, kicking things off on the first night, was the former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott, who has been an unflinching and unapologetic conservative throughout his career. And as always, former politicians tend to get even more candid, but he was pretty candid when he was in office as well. It's my great pleasure to have Tony Abbott on the show now. Tony, thank you for being with us, and welcome to Canada.
Andrew, it's wonderful to be here, and I've got to say, this has been a bracing and invigorating conference. Good to see so many hundreds of often young conservatives, very enthusiastic and ambitious for the next government here in Canada.
Let me ask you about, and just for some context for those not familiar with Australian politics, the Liberal Party there, with a capital L, is the Conservative Party with a small c. But that party, how does it situate itself if you were to compare it against the Tories of Canada, the Tories of Britain, and that global conservative landscape on what Australian conservatism is?
We are very much the Australian equivalent of your Conservative Party or the British Conservative Party, but like your party and Britain's party, we go through more conservative and more progressive phases. Under me, the party was more conservative. Under my successor, the party was less conservative. But under Peter Dutton, the current leader of the Liberal National Coalition in Australia, the party, I think, has gone back to being a proper small-c conservative party. And look, we're in opposition now. And as I said constantly as opposition leader, the job of an opposition is to be a strong alternative, not to make weak compromises with a bad left-wing government.
One of the fascinating things when we look at these shifts is that in Canada, there's been a great realignment over the pandemic era. And I think in Australia, where some of the COVID restrictions were worse than anywhere else in the world.
Totally over the top.
That was a particular flashpoint. In Canada, we had the trucker protest. In Australia, has there been a similar resurgence from that?
I think that a lot of people on the centre-right were very dismayed by the way even supposedly conservative governments connived at restrictions on freedom and increases in the size of government, which were simply unprecedented, even in wartime. So I think that the pandemic, while deeply dispiriting in so many ways, and culturally weakening in so many ways, has certainly reminded conservatives of the fact that these values, these important, enduring, I think eternal values that are in the marrow of our bones, have to be asserted and defended, not watered down, because too much of that happened during the pandemic, and too often that's happened in periods of government. We've split the difference rather than standing up for the smaller government, lower taxes, greater freedom, respect for the family, small business, and institutions that have stood the test of time, and above all else, love of country, because at the heart of our political tradition is freedom, tradition, and above all else, patriotism. Mm.
One distinction I was wondering if you could help demystify for me and the audience is on firearms policy, because in Canada, the Conservative Party's position on firearms is generally about less controls, less restrictions, certainly not the American model, whereas some of the big gun control in Australia came about under John Howard, who's a otherwise very stoic, stalwart Conservative. So how in the political culture has that happened in a party that otherwise supports property and freedom?
Look, we just have a different approach to guns. We always have. Maybe it's because the settlement process was different in our country than in North America. But we've just had a different approach to guns. And look, I'm all in favour of farmers having guns. If you've got a property, you may have pests that you need to shoot. There may be animals that you need to put down as humanely as possible and quickly, and obviously if you've got an old 303, it's a very good way of doing that. And if you're a sporting shooter, fine. By all means, have access to guns. So I'm not, in a sense, anti-gun, but I don't have this thing about an armed population. I suspect a heavily armed population is more danger to itself than it is any bad guys.
Let's talk about what you and Boris Johnson on Wednesday had actually a very lively and spirited exchange on, which was climate policy. And just for a bit of context, when we hear this discussed in Canada, oftentimes the Liberals and the Conservatives start from the same core premise, which is that, yes, climate change is serious. It's predominantly caused by man. We've got to reduce emissions. And they differ on how to do that and how much to do that. You went actually a step further and challenged that core premise. You said, actually, I'm not convinced it's predominantly man-made. And that's a position that I would love for a Canadian politician to have the courage to utter on stage.
Well, it's a position that I've pretty consistently had. When I was Prime Minister, I had a little mantra, if you like, and my mantra was climate change happens. We have to assume that mankind makes a contribution. We should do what we can to reduce emissions, but not if it costs jobs, drives industries offshore, and adds to people's cost of living. Now, we know that climate changes. The Ice Ages, classic case of climate change. The Roman warm period, the medieval warm period, classic cases of climate change. And ask yourself what caused them. I mean, seriously, ask yourself what caused the Ice Age. Now, it plainly wasn't mankind's carbon dioxide emissions because there were hardly any of us. There was no factories or anything like that. Now, if the most dramatic example of climate change that we're familiar with had absolutely nothing to do with mankind's emissions, obviously there are many factors in climate change, and there's no real reason to think that the most significant one is mankind's carbon dioxide. So, look, on sort of good prudential principles, and as someone who appreciates we've only got one planet, we've got to look after it, I'm all in favour of resting lightly on it. But it's not just sensible. In fact, it's utter folly to turn our world upside down in this mania for reducing emissions. Why shouldn't we continue to drive V8 cars? Why shouldn't we continue to eat beef? Why shouldn't we continue to enrich our countries and help other countries by mining and exporting coal and by drilling and exporting gas. Why shouldn't we keep flying for business and pleasure? And what's behind a lot of the more extreme climate activism is actually a hatred for our way of life. And in many ways, this is a cause that's been adopted by quasi-Marxists who have been much more successful at getting the middle class to revolt in the name of saving the planet than they ever were at getting the working class to revolt in the name of economic equality.
And where I really diverge with Boris Johnson's perspective on this is that he distilled it to the old thought experiment of Pascal's wager, where he said, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, maybe it's really bad, maybe it's not. But effectively, he said it costs us nothing to act as though...
Which is complete nonsense.
This is where
his argument completely fell down, where the analogy didn't work, because it's cost us already trillions of dollars to make all these changes to combat climate change, as we think, and to what end and to what benefit? Emissions are going up because whatever India and China say, for all sorts of reasons, quite sensible reasons, they are continuing to burn coal, to use gas, to use oil, and frankly, modern life is absolutely impossible without fossil fuels. At enormous expense and massive inconvenience and economic weakening and strategic weakening of ourselves, we could move to wind and solar power. But we can't do without steel. We can't do without plastic. We can't do without fertilizer. And these are all critically dependent on fossil fuels. And there is no likely a medium-term substitute without, again, massive expense. And this idea that we should impoverish ourselves in the name of reducing emissions when nothing we do in our countries is going to make a difference to overall levels of carbon dioxide because China and India are not doing the same thing, it's crackers. It's absolute crackers. It's an act of economic and ultimately social and strategic self-harm, and the sooner we wake up to ourselves, the better. But I notice just overnight, the UN climate chief has set a new deadline of doom. We've got just 2 years.
Oh, only 2 years now.
To save the planet. Well, I mean, all these deadlines have come and gone, and the planet seems to be rocking along.
Yes, yes.
We're still here, and the very best thing we can do to deal with whatever comes, including any changes in climate down the track, is to keep ourselves strong and free. That's what we should do. Keep ourselves strong and free. And policy that makes us less strong and ultimately less free is no good thing, whatever the supposed justification.
Perhaps you can explain from your experience as a head of government how politicians who are elected in Western democracies around the world from liberal parties, conservative parties, more socialist parties, all tend to sound the same when they're at the global forums and the global summits talking about this. I mean, the Paris Agreement, the COP summits, I mean, even Boris Johnson when the UK was hosting the COP summit. It seems like all of these domestic realities tend to lose when that amorphous global community gets together.
Well, let me tell you this, Andrew. Lots of people in my party, when I became opposition leader back in 2009, and lots of people in the commentariat said that I was unelectable because I wasn't prepared to accept the consensus, in inverted commas, on climate change. And what I was able to do as opposition leader, and I think to some extent as Prime Minister as well, was to turn this from an environmental issue and a moral issue into an economic issue and a pragmatic issue.
Which is what it is for ordinary people.
And let me point this out to the benefit of any nervous Canadian Conservatives. Three elections in Australia were largely fought on the issue of climate and our response to climate and energy resulting from climate policies. 2010, 2013, and 2019, and in every single one of them, the more sceptical party did extremely well and campaigning against a carbon tax, I won a landslide victory in 2013. Sure, if you look at the opinion polls, people will say we want to see emissions reduced and we think climate change is important. But if you then ask them how much are they prepared to pay, $100, $1,000, $1 million bucks, the answer is we are not prepared to pay. And this is why the green zealots, the climate cultists, have constantly promised us that renewable energy is cheap, even free. Well, it might be cheap when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, but we need electricity 24/7. And that means that intermittent wind and solar power has always got to be backed up at massive expense, and as well, you need a gargantuan new transmission grid, transmission system to cope with this decentralized grid. But all of the new transmission infrastructure is only being used 30% of the time, given that it's only on average 30% of the time that the sun is shining and the wind is blowing.
And I think the caution in that, and we saw this in the Canadian election in 2021, where a Conservative Party tried to do the carbon tax thing and was resoundingly defeated because voters didn't want it, didn't buy it. And if they wanted that, they would have voted for the left in general.
Politics is a contest. It's a contest of ideas. And quite apart from the fact that I think that carbon taxes and this whole emissions obsession is wrong in principle, absolutely wrong in principle, why would you do something that's wrong in principle, which actually blurs the difference between you and the other side of politics, particularly given that these emissions obsessive policies are so damaging to aspirational working class people who need their pickup truck, who want to heat their house in winter and cool their house in summer, who want to have a good, honest, blue-collar job in a car factory or a steel mill or a timber mill or something like that. I mean, you know, why are we attacking the working class the way we are? And one of the reasons why, over the last generation, you've seen more, if you like, poorer people moving to the right and richer people moving to the green left is because, in the end, this whole climate thing is the ultimate first world problem. When you don't have anything else to fret about, you suddenly worry about maybe the planet might be a couple of degrees warmer in 3 or 4 decades' time. Well, look, maybe it will, maybe it won't. If it is, I think it's unlikely to be mankind that's driven that, much more likely to be sunspot activities or oscillations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And given that there are other far more pressing problems right now, in particular Islamist aggression in the Middle East, in particular the ongoing aggression by dictatorships such as Russia and the Chinese communists, we have challenges all around the world right now. And the last thing we should be doing is weakening ourselves in dealing with those challenges by obsessing over climate. I mean, ask yourself this. Are the Ukrainians worried about their emissions at the moment? Are the Israelis thinking about how we can put in more wind and solar power? No. They have got existential issues to worry about. And we have to remember that we're not necessarily entirely free of having to deal with the same things ourselves.
Just in closing, Tony, you've spent now a few days with Canadian Conservatives. What can the Australian right perhaps learn from Canada, and what can the Canadian right learn from Australia?
Well, I hope that people in Canada might look at my experience in opposition and in government and be confident that you can take on tough issues, go against the elite consensus and win a thumping majority. And without wanting to put tickets on myself, so far the Abbott government is the only government in the world that has repealed a carbon tax and which successfully stopped a wave of illegal migration by small boat. And if we can do it, others can do it. Now, as for Canada teaching us good lessons, I'm really impressed at the way Pierre Poilievre has really galvanized conservatives in this country. Mm-hmm. And I can sense at conferences like this a real passion and a strong ambition to get into government and to make a difference. Now, I think that Canada has to some extent been in the doldrums one way or another for the last decade. So I think it needs reinvigoration. But there's a real sense of purpose about your opposition leader and a real sense of enthusiasm at conferences like this. And frankly, the Anglosphere needs a strong conservative government to succeed because it's a while since we've had one which has unambiguously succeeded, and let's hope Canada is the start of a new wave.
Former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
The former Prime Minister of Australia, an Anglophile, a big advocate for the conservative movement, not just in his own country, but around the world. And I would also point out there that you can agree or disagree with his position on it, but there's something in politics that we often call the Overton window, which is in society, the really the realm of acceptable opinions within civil discourse. And I think Tony Abbott has done a lot in Australia, and even he's shared it in that interview, to kind of extend the boundaries of that so that you can have certain discussions that again, even in a Canadian political context, you'd be unlikely to see from any party. So perhaps some lessons there that politicians can take. But what a wonderful warm-up act Tony Abbott is to my next guest, Paige McPherson, who is with the Fraser Institute. She's an expert and all-seeing eye on all things education. We've had her on the show a number of times on this. And I wanted to take it in a little bit of a broader way today and talk about education and educational policy in a context of family policy and an issue that we'll be touching on as well with Ginny Roth in an interview that we'll share with you next week. But Paige McPherson, always good to see you. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Andrew.
You and I have spoken because you're a great advocate for school choice, for parents to have choices to send their kids to schools, not just this, you know, weird binary that we have in Ontario where you can do, you know, public or Catholic, but in Alberta perhaps, where you have charter schools, you have this independent schooling mentality baked into the public system. I was wondering if you could extend that a little bit because you touched on it in a discussion here about really what choices are available, and I'd say more pressingly what choices aren't available to families and mothers who make a lot of these decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think that it's important to kind of frame it in the question of, do families and women, if you want to talk about it from a sort of female empowerment point of view, do we actually have the freedom to make the choices that we want to make with our kids from day one, looking at sort of family policy, maternity leave, where you're going to send your kids to childcare, and then, of course, as they get older, where you're going to send your kids to school. And in certain provinces, as you've mentioned, when it comes to educational choice, as an example, in the Maritimes, where I live, and in Ontario, where you live, no, educational choice is extremely limited. In Quebec and in Western Canada, from Manitoba West, yeah, you've got more funded options that a portion of a parent's tax dollars will follow their children to the school of their choice. But I think it's an important question to ask right now in the context of the rising cost of living, even when these choice avenues are available through policy. It's still a lot easier to make the prescribed government choice. So in the context of childcare policy with the new government daycare program, that's sending your child to a $10 a day subsidized daycare center. In the context of schools, that's sending your child to the local government public school. And of course, you can make another choice for your family. But looking at the data and asking the question, how easy and how feasible actually is it to make those choices for many families, I think is another question altogether.
And certainly when you talk about it in a healthcare context, and I've had this discussion with some of your colleagues at the Fraser Institute, we see that universalization limits choice. It limits options. And anytime government tries to take this universal approach to something, it ends up where you have this one-size-fits-all position. And I think the Ontario schooling example and the Eastern Canada schooling example is there. That's kind of the childcare approach as well. All of a sudden, you force people into this government constraint. And, you know, I'm wondering how we break out of that, because I can't imagine if you went around and polled the average parent that you would get much resistance if you said, hey, should you have more choice? Should you have more options? You're not saying you have to take your kid out of the public
public system, and yet still these policies are pretty firmly in place in these provinces. Mm-hmm. So I know in healthcare why that happens, because people have this very fearful scenario that any change to the status quo will mean a dilution of care, a dilution of access, a dilution of being able to get something at low or no cost. Is that the same thing in healthcare? Is that why nothing's really changing?
Well, I think an interesting distinction between education and childcare policy and then healthcare policy in Canada mm-hmm. is that in Canada, in healthcare, you often don't have any other option unless you're going to go to another country yes. to seek that option, right?
Yeah, and the out-of-pocket private school doesn't exist for healthcare.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yes, there are independent schools in Canada. There are childcare options you're permitted by the government yeah. to do, right? You can send your child to a private day home, for example, that doesn't fall under the government regulation and subsidy program. You can get an aunt or a grandmother to work less and, you know, split childcare with you. You can choose to stay home with your children. Mm-hmm. It's become very difficult to make that choice, to take the road less traveled that isn't the government avenue that they've created by this massive expanding state, essentially, becomes difficult. And that's for a number of reasons. On the one hand, if you look at childcare policy, for example, okay, if you're going to go back to work when you have a child and you're going to need childcare for them, you probably are going to make more than $10 a day, right? And if you've got a $10 a day daycare option, then sending your child to that daycare is probably going to be the financially better scenario for you in the short term, even if it's not really your preferred option. Even if as a woman you'd love to stay home in the early years with your child, mm-hmm. it becomes less expensive in the shorter term for you to do that. The other thing is that when you have these massively expanding government programs, you've got the debt and tax burden to go along with that. We know that government spending is at, you know, record highs. We know that debt interest payments at the government level that Canadians are of course responsible for paying via their taxes they're at record highs. We know that the debt the tax burden for Canadian families, that Canadian families on average are now spending more of their income yeah. on taxes than they are on the necessities of life, on food, clothing, and shelter. And you've been to a grocery store, you know yep. that you're spending a heck of a lot of money on food, clothing, and shelter. Not to mention housing costs, right? But you're still spending, on average, about 45% of your income on taxes. Mm-hmm. And that's to pay for these large government programs. So, again, yes, in theory, you can send your child to a different child care option. You can make that choice for your family. You can send your child to an independent school that you're going to have to pay for in Ontario or the Maritimes fully out of pocket. But even in Alberta, you're going to have to pay some cost yeah. in addition to, you know, the tax dollars that are following your child to that school. So it really becomes the question of, okay, families can, in theory, make this choice, but how realistic is it?
Well, and I think that it touches on an important point, because I was raised, I went briefly to a Catholic school in Ontario, which is part of the public system, and then I did most of my schooling, primary and your elementary and secondary in the public school. And I had always been raised with this mindset that a private school was really just a wealthy elite thing, that you do it because you could. And it was only older that I started to realize that there are different motivations for it. And actually, you and I have spoken about some of the data on this. Overwhelmingly, the people that choose private schooling options or homeschooling are certainly not wealthy. Mm-hmm. And they do it because they feel that their needs are not being met by the public school system, either their needs on a quality of education or even the content of education. And I think that part's also missing, is why parents feel so underserved or unserved by the public system in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point. So we have research on this, particularly in Alberta and BC, where mm-hmm. we drill down on the average incomes of families who send their kids to independent schools or send their kids to the government public schools. And really, those incomes end up being extremely similar, especially when you remove the very small proportion of independent schools that are those sort of elite yeah. prep schools. That's the image that is sometimes conjured
for people. Yeah, that was all I thought
people.
A private school was
right.
for most of my life.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but in reality, as you say, you know, the majority of independent schools in Canada are cultural or religious schools. You know, you've got schools that have a typical or an interesting sort of philosophical approach, like a Montessori school, a Waldorf school. That a forest school is a growing movement in Canada. So elite prep schools is actually quite a small proportion of that. But what's interesting, I think, about what you're saying is that a lot of people don't know that the sort of government avenue is not going to be the best choice for their family until they take it, right? Until they have their child in a government public school classroom and they realize, okay, this is not working. It could be for a whole number of reasons, right? We hear from people who are experiencing bullying or violence in school, and it's just not the right fit for them. It's the curriculum is not getting to them. They're not reading. They're not able to do math. They maybe have a different learning style. Maybe they have special education needs. There's a whole host of reasons why families might decide that the government public school is not the best fit for their child and want to put them in another school, and they might not realize that right off the hop. But once they do realize that, the idea that only a family that is of significant means that can afford a nanny or can afford to pay out of pocket for independent school tuition on top of paying for subsidized daycare and government schools for everybody else, in, you know, via their very large tax burden that we've already discussed, that's really not fair. If your family really shouldn't have to have that level of income to be able to do that. What is interesting, though, in our data as well is that a lot of families, they're certainly not wealthy. They're making these choices. They involve tremendous sacrifices, and they're still making those choices. We know that homeschooling is going up as a share of students in 9 out of 10 provinces. We know that independent schools enrollment is growing as a share or a proportion of total students in every single province in the country. Wow. So people are making these choices despite the cost of living going up, but we also know that it involves a tremendous level of sacrifice for a lot of these families.
I know your focus is on the policy and not the politics, but is there any real movement in any province? Let me back up. Is this issue on the agenda for any opposition parties in any province in Canada? Is there any movement to the status quo that's really being championed anywhere?
I mean, so like you said, I mean, I really look at the policy, not the politics as much. I mean, I know Danielle Smith in Alberta has talked about potentially expanding school choice in that
province. But they're already the one that's furthest ahead,
I know.
Right?
They offer already the most choice.
There's no one in Ontario trying to blow up the system here, and certainly in your province, I don't think there is either.
No, there's really not a lot of movement, but there are a lot of parents that are dissatisfied, I think, with what their kids are getting in government public school. You know, there's a lot of parents that are, they want to have more of an ability to be active in their child's school, to be informed about what their child is learning in school, understand, again, and this is one of those things that sometimes you don't realize it's an issue until it's too late. Your child is suddenly entering third grade and they can't read. Yeah. And that's the critical age at which we know it switches from learning to read to reading to learn. Your child's going to have to know how to read in order to succeed educationally. And yet, here you are, and you don't have any other options.
Yeah.
So, of course, there's a lot of parents, and I would say there is, you know, in political terms, the political constituency there that absolutely does care about this issue. And sometimes it's just the case that people don't really even know that there are these other options. I don't know that people in Nova Scotia necessarily know the educational choice policy structure in British Columbia, right? And so, of course, that's a part of the work that we do.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing more of it. You always produce very interesting facts and figures on this. Paige McPherson from the Fraser Institute. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Paige. We will certainly check in on that. And as I said, on Monday, we're going to have a discussion with Ginny Roth on birth rates, which are a very key part of this. And basically, what, if anything, government and governments should be doing to start promoting families. And a lot of what Paige was talking about there was the idea of family first policy. It's not government centrally planning the composition or structure of family. It's about giving options, or at the very least not taking options away. But in the vein of birth rates, we can't talk about Canada's population without talking about immigration, which has long been relied on as really the lone avenue for population growth in this country. We hear time and time again politicians say, well, birth rates are too low, we've got to boost our numbers through immigration. And as we've seen in the last couple of weeks in particular, Canada's immigration has led to an unsustainable path. We have the federal government itself even admitting that it has had far beyond, those were its words, far beyond what Canada is able to absorb in terms of temporary residents combined with new permanent residents. And to give you some context on this, government has committed to about 500,000 new permanent residents a year, but the number of new temporary residents a year is over 1 million, and that includes
foreign students, temporary foreign workers, people that come in through other channels. So you have a large volume of people coming to Canada and a country that economically cannot sustain even those who are here already. So let's talk about this in context of what a conservative government would do about it. I spoke about this with Pierre Poilievre in December, and he was hesitant to give a specific figure for what a conservative government would advance. But he also did say there'd be a formula in place, and I wanted to delve into that a bit more detail with the Conservatives immigration critic, Tom Kmitch. I'm speaking right now with the Conservative immigration critic, also a Calgary MP, the MP for Calgary Shepherd, Tom Kmitch. Tom, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So, obviously, immigration has become a hot-button issue in politics. What's been fascinating is how the Liberals have decided to do a complete about-face on what's really been their position for quite some time. How did you feel when you got that concession from Justin Trudeau within the last couple of weeks that Canada has actually bungled this, that Canada has actually admitted through temporary residency far more than what he said the country could absorb?
So, I mean, it's a bit ridiculous for the Prime Minister to claim that he suddenly discovered that things aren't going the way that he maybe thought that it was. He's the one that's been appointing all these immigration ministers. I guess he doesn't read any of the briefing notes or documents that come up his way. We found that out at the inquiry. He doesn't read national security documents. He's not reading immigration documents. It's obvious. And, you know, this is just a continuation, because back in August, when he reshuffled his own cabinet, you had this bizarre situation where the previous immigration minister could not let go of his department, who was saying that things are a mess. That's a direct quote. And the new minister said things are out of control. And they've been fighting it out in public between the senior immigration minister and the junior immigration minister. And now the prime minister has weighed in and accused this government of basically failing on the job, that they're not competent, obviously, except he's the one that's appointed everybody. He's been in charge for almost 9 years now, and they broke the immigration system. And it's nice of him to recognize that he broke it.
Pierre Poilievre, on my show and now elsewhere, has talked about what his approach to immigration will be. He said that immigration should be tied to a couple of key indicators, such as job availability, healthcare resources, and also, I think, in general, when you're looking at just the well-being of the country, those economic focal points have been where he's gone. Can you give any more clarity on what a conservative immigration plan would look like in a platform or what you would like to do in a conservative government on this?
So, I mean, what I'd love to do in the Conservative government is help the next immigration minister figure out what the formula should be. And right now it's, you know, broad terms, healthcare, housing, jobs equals, that will be whatever it equals to. And then we'll have to create that, you know, very objective way of calculating how many people should be allowed to be in Canada, to be working here, studying here, reuniting with families, all of it together. And I think those are three very reasonable metrics to have. And what are the inputs into those metrics, like how exactly we'll look at, closer to election, we'll obviously give it to the public so they can, you know, make a determination. Do we have a better way of doing and managing our immigration system, or do they prefer the chaos and the brokenness that the Liberals have created over 8 years?
If that calculation leads to a permanent resident number that is lower than the target now, is that something that you would be willing to stand behind?
So it's going to be more than just permanent immigration. It's going to be also temporary resident immigration, because the problem isn't the permanent residency ones. Like, those PR numbers are often quoted by individuals in Canada. About 45 to 55% of those, depending on the year, actually people who are physically in Canada already, they're just changing their status from studying, from working here on a temporary foreign work permit, and they're becoming permanent residents of Canada, hopefully on their pathway to becoming citizens and, you know, joining the Canadian family. So half of those are already here. We're talking about everybody. It'll be an all-encompassing number, including everyone. So I don't want to limit it just to PRs.
But to be direct about that, do you think that number is going to have to be lower than what it is right now?
It'll be whatever it comes out to, that will be the number. If it's lower, it's lower. If it's higher, it's higher. But we see what the housing construction is looking like. The number's going down in terms of the number of dwellings being completed per year. Healthcare services are stretched in some provinces, sometimes beyond the limit. That's what I heard in Vancouver when I was there a few weeks ago. That's what I hear in Toronto when I'm there. Like, we don't have a family doctor crisis in Calgary. There are actually signs saying family doctors accepting new patients. So this is my pitch to your listeners and viewers. Like, if you want a family doctor, no, Calgary's a beautiful place. It's the most beautiful city in Canada, that they can move and find a family doctor, but also jobs, job vacancy rates, job unemployment rates, in specific sectors of the economy are looking for more people than others, such as construction. All of that will be affected. There'll be a total number at the end, and that will be the final number.
Do you think that it's reasonable to restrict the immigration calculation to economic indicators? I know the previous conservative government looked at values-based things, and certainly since October 7th, we've seen some examples of people where there is not a consensus on core beliefs. And I'm wondering how that would factor into your ideal scenario for immigration.
I'm always worried about introducing things like that are not fixed, like values, because that should be up to civic society to decide. Like, I don't want my government determining which values it supports, which doesn't. And the reason I don't like it is because for the last 9 years, that's the Liberal government of Canada. That's what they've been doing. They've been telling you if you ran, you know, a school camp program and you thought that it should be based on like a Bible teachings, that you were a bad person, and they applied a values attestation test to whether you could receive a bit of taxpayer funds to hire a couple of camp counselors. And if you were running, you know, like a resettlement program, they made you tell them, do you support certain values or not? So that's what I'm always worried about, is when you allow the government to determine which values it's going to promote, which it doesn't, then you get the Liberal Party of Canada doing what it's done for the past 9 years. So I believe like things like healthcare, housing, jobs, all Canadians can get behind that and be like, yeah, those are reasonable, objective metrics. There's no subjectivity to them. You either have those services or you don't, and there'll be a number, and we can then debate whether the inputs are correct or not. And then it's a debate about what are the inputs that should be going into it. You want more immigration? Build more housing. Get the policies into place to make housing cheaper so that people can get into more housing. You want more doctors, more healthcare services? Well, make it easier for doctors to practice. We have over 20,000 internationally trained doctors who cannot practice their profession. In fact, there are less doctors practicing today than there were like 20, 30, 40 years ago as a percentage out of it, like per thousand. And same thing for nurses. There's over, I think, 32,000 internationally trained nurses who can't practice the profession, the occupation that they love, because colleges are blocking them from doing so. So the country of origin lost a nurse. We didn't gain a nurse. We just have people who are disgruntled because they can't practice their profession, likely working a survival job.
Election currently scheduled for fall of 2025. If you had your way, when would you be going to the polls?
The same thing my constituents are saying immediately right now. Non-confidence, as many non-confidence votes as it takes to topple the government. Let's have an election, a carbon tax election, and let the Liberals defend raising the cost of living on everyone.
Tom Kmitch, thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
That was my interview with the Conservative immigration critic, Calgary Shepherd MP Tom Kmitch. Now, one thing I'll point out there is that the Conservatives' position now, which is we won an election yesterday, is a nice departure from in 2021, where Justin Trudeau called an election and the Conservatives were wondering why. And they're like, no, stay in power. You're doing a great job. We don't want a campaign right now. So that is in and of itself quite interesting. And it's the Liberals who are a bit hesitant to go to the polls, perhaps because the polls show their numbers to be lower than Stephen Guilbeault's IQ, which is actually quite a feat if you think about it. But that's actually the real net zero, by the way, Stephen Guilbeault's IQ. But one thing I wanted to talk about on this is that this is the first time I've heard a Conservative official, a senior Conservative MP, talk about the possibility that Canada's immigration targets could be lower. Now, he says, look, we'll run the formula. If it's lower, it's lower. It's higher, it's higher. But they're actually willing at this point to say what Pierre Poilievre didn't really, when I spoke to him in December about this, admit that that could be lower. So I think that in and of itself is a bit of movement, and I think it's also a sign that the immigration consensus in Canada has shifted dramatically on this. Again, when the Liberals came out in, I forget it was the beginning of last week or 2 weeks ago, and said what a lot of Canadians have said, which is, okay, we've got a little bit of a crunch here. We don't have enough houses. We don't have enough jobs. We don't have enough in the way of healthcare resources. That is a big problem. But the Liberal problem here is that they are neglecting to address the fact that they have been the ones at the helm. They've been the ones there in power for the last 8 years. So any problems that exist have happened on their watch. Now, I wanted to, as we wrap up our week here at the Canada Strong and Free Network's annual conference in Ottawa, just share a bit of a final thought, if you will, because it's been a great time, and I've met a lot of people that are big members and supporters of True North Nation out there, and have had lots of great things to say about our work and our coverage and our team, and I'm so grateful for that. This is an event that I realize is only a subset of the Conservative movement. I had a message from someone yesterday, actually, that took a very anti-CSFN look and said, well, this is just for the rich who can go to Ottawa, and I'd say it's actually for the what is it? If you like pain, are you a sadist or a masochist? I always forget, but
I think you're a sadist. You're mad. Whatever one means you like inflicting pain. That's the type of person that goes to Ottawa voluntarily. But the thing about it that I will point out here is that there is a group that comes here, and you've obviously got your lobbyists and your political staffers and your politicos. But I have met people that are more grassroots populists from the West. I've met people that are young up and comers, keen conservatives. I've met Red Tories. So there is a coalition here. But I'm very keenly aware of the fact that the people I've been meeting in the halls here do not represent the totality of the right of center movement. And by that I include, you know, the Red Tory, Blue Tory, fiscal conservatives, libertarian, social conservatives, fiscal hawks, property rights, rurals, all of these types of people that I think are a part of this coalition in the country that doesn't often agree on everything, and in some cases might not even agree on most things. And what's fascinating is that everyone has their red line. And over the course of the pandemic, we saw a lot of people who might be economic socialists that saw their red line was personal freedom and bodily autonomy. People that would never identify as being on the right that all of a sudden found no home on the left because of what that was happening through the COVID era. I did an interview earlier with a former Liberal member of Parliament, Dan McTagg, that I'll share with you next week, in which he talks about his departure from the Liberal Party. But as he describes it, it was actually the Liberal Party's departure from him. And I think that's a fascinating thing we need to keep an eye on in the conservative movement and coalition. Now, just to do the shameless plug here, I have a biography coming out in the next month about conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. And one of the fascinating things I had sort of touched on in that book, I think it's fascinating anyway, is that Poilievre's development as a politician, as a political leader, has really tracked the development and evolution of the modern conservative movement. He was a young reform activist in Alberta in the 1990s. He was part of the fight to change that into the Reform Party. He was part of the fight to merge the Reform Alliance Party with the PC Party, and then form the Conservative Party of Canada, which he contested a seat in, was elected and was a member of Parliament and has been for the 20 years that party has been in existence. So that's in and of itself a fascinating story here. And you look at how Preston Manning, who founded the Canada Strong and Free Network as the Manning Center some years back, how Preston Manning has influenced this. So I don't think it's an elite gathering. I think you can say it's a gathering that has some elites, just as the conservative movement in this country has some elites. But one thing that is fascinating here is the level of enthusiasm and momentum. It has been a very dark period of time for people that don't like Justin Trudeau for the last several years, because they keep seeing Justin Trudeau get elected and re-elected and re-elected and wonder how. This past year has been the first time I've seen a monumental shift where conservatives don't just seem happy to vote out Justin Trudeau, but seem to be more secure in voting for something else and putting forward a positive vision that isn't just an opposition-based thing. And again, not everyone is going to rally behind Pierre Poilievre and the capital C Conservative Party of Canada, but there does seem to be a lot more of a grounded sense of what conservatives are fighting for with a small c, what people in the movement are fighting for. So we'll leave it there for this week. We'll have more interviews from the Canada Strong and Free Networks Conference as the show progresses next week. I'll be back in the regular studio then. But thank you to all of you who have been tuning in. And if I can just say, being here is important. There are a lot of people that we really don't get the chance to speak to, like Tony Abbott, for example. But there is a cost in doing this. We have a great video setup. It's been phenomenal. It is expensive, though. If you can support the work we're doing, please head on over to donate.tnc.news. Donate.tnc.news. But thank you. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you. God bless. And have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.